me that you might. He was just a man I used to know. I see. Well, he picked up some papers. So, that's the way it is, my boy. A little later, perhaps, we'll be able to do something. You may take the papers along if you wish. Just mail them to us. Your check will be sent upon their return. Meanwhile, take as much time as you like. You'll find that we are perfectly fair. I took the folded papers and looked at him for what seemed to be too long a time. He seemed to waver. Then I heard myself say, "Do you know him?" my voice rising. "Who?" "Mr. Norton," I said. "Mr. Norton." "Oh, why no?" "No," I said. "No one knows anybody." And it was too long a time ago. He frowned, and I laughed. "They picked poor Robin clean," I said. "Do you happen to know Bled?" He looked at me, his head to one side. "Are these people friends of yours?" "Friends." "Oh, yes," I said. "We're all good friends, buddies from way back, but I don't suppose we get around in the same circles." His eyes widened. "No," he said, "I don't suppose we do. However, good friends are valuable to have." I felt lightheaded and started to laugh, and he seemed to waver again, and I thought of asking him about Emerson, but now he was clearing his throat and indicating that he was finished. I put the folded papers in my overalls and started out. The door beyond the rows of chairs seemed far away. "Take care of yourself," he said. "And you," I said, thinking, "it's time. It's past time." Turning abruptly, I went weakly back to the desk, seeing him looking up at me with his steady, scientific gaze. I was overcome with ceremonial feelings, but unable to remember the proper formula. So as I deliberately extended my hand, I fought down laughter with a cough. "It's been quite pleasant, our little palaver, sir," I said. I listened to myself and to his answer. "Yes, indeed," he said. He shook my hand gravely, without surprise or distaste. I looked down. He was there somewhere behind the lined face and outstretched hand. "And now our palaver is finished," I said. "Goodbye." He raised his hand. "Goodbye," he said, his voice noncommittal. Leaving him and going out into the paint-fuming air, I had the feeling that I had been talking beyond myself, had used words and expressed attitudes not my own, that I was in the grip of some alien personality lodged deep within me, like the servant about whom I'd read in psychology class who, during a trance, had recited pages of Greek philosophy, which she had overheard one day while she worked. It was as though I were acting out a scene from some crazy movie. Or perhaps I was catching up with myself and had put into words feelings which I had hitherto suppressed. Or was it, I thought, starting up the walk, that I was no longer afraid? I stopped, looking at the buildings down the bright street slanting with sun and shade. I was no longer afraid. Not of important men, not of trustees and such. For knowing now that there was nothing which I could expect from them, there was no reason to be afraid. Was that it? I felt lightheaded. My ears were ringing. I went on. Along the walk, the buildings rose, uniform and close together. It was day's end now, and on top of every building the flags were fluttering and diving down, collapsing. And I felt that I would fall, had fallen, move now as against a current sweeping swiftly against me. Out of the grounds and up the street I found the bridge by which I'd come, but the stairs leading back to the car that crossed the top were too dizzily steep to climb, swim, or fly. And I found a subway instead. Things whirled too fast around me. My mind went alternately bright and blank in slow rolling waves. We, he, him, my mind and I were no longer getting around in the same circles, nor my body either. Across the aisle, a young platinum blonde nibbled at a red, delicious apple as station lights rippled past behind her. The train plunged. I dropped through the roar, giddy and vacuum-minded, sucked under and out into late afternoon Harlem. When I came out of the subway, Lenox Avenue seemed to careen away from me at a drunken angle, and I focused upon the teetering scene with wild infant's eyes, my head throbbing. Two huge women with spoiled cream complexions seemed to struggle with their massive bodies as they came past, their flowered hips trembling like threatening flames. Out across the walk before me they moved, and a bright orange slant of sun seemed to boil up, and I saw myself going down, my legs watery beneath me, but my head clear, too clear, recording the crowd swerving around me, legs, feet, eyes, hands, bent knees, scuffed shoes, teethy-eyed excitement, and some moving on, unhalting, and the big dark woman saying, "Boy, is you all right? What's wrong?" in a husky voice contralto, and me saying, I'm all right, just weak, and trying to stand, and her saying, "Why don't y'all stand back and let the man breathe? Stand back there, y'all," and now echoed by an official tone, "Keep moving, break it up." And she on one side and a man on the other, helping me to stand, and the policeman saying, "Are you all right?" and me answering, "Yes, I just felt weak. I must have fainted, but all right now." And him ordering the crowd to move on, and the others moving on except the man and woman, and him saying, "You sure you okay, Daddy?" And me nodding, "Yes," and her saying, "Where you live, son? Somewhere around here?" And me telling her, "Men's house," and her looking at me, shaking her head, saying, "Men's house? Men's house? Shucks, that ain't no place for nobody in your condition what's weak and needs a woman to keep an eye on you a while." And me saying, "But I'll be all right now." And her, "Maybe you will be and maybe you won't. I just live up the street and round the corner. You better come on round and rest till you feel stronger. I'll phone men's house and tell them where you at." And me too tired to resist, and already she had one arm and was instructing the fellow to take the other, and we went, me between them, inwardly rejecting and yet accepting her bossing, hearing, "You take it easy. I'll take care of you like I've done a heap of others. My name's Mary Rambo. Everybody knows me around this part of Harlem. You heard of me, ain't you?" And the fellow saying, "Sure, I'm Jenny Jackson's boy. You know I know you, Miss Mary." And her saying, "Jenny Jackson? Why, I should say you do know me. And I know you. You Ralston. And your mama got two more children, boy named Flint, gal named Laura Jean. I should say I know you. Me and your mama and your papa used to..." And me saying, I'm all right now, really, really, all right." And her saying, "And looking like that, you must be worse off even than you look." And pulling me now, saying, "Here's my house right here. Let me get him up the steps and inside. You needn't worry, son. I ain't never laid eyes on you before, and it ain't my business. And I don't care what you think about me, but you weak and can't hardly walk at all, and you look what's more like you hungry. So just come on and let me do something for you, like I'd hope you'd do something for old Mary in case she needed it. It ain't costing you a penny. And I don't want to get in your business. I just want you to lay down till you rested, and then you can go." And the fellow taking it up, saying, "You in good hands, Daddy. Miss Mary always helping somebody. And you need some help, because here you black as me and white as a sheet, as the old phase would say. Watch these steps." And going up some steps, and then some more, growing weaker, and the two warm around me on each side of me, and then inside a cool, dark room, hearing,
"Here, here's the bed. Lie him down there. There, there now, that's it. Ralston, now put his legs up. Never mind the cover. There, that's it. Now, go out there in the kitchen and pour him a glass of water. You'll find a bottle in the ice box."
And him going, and her placing another pillow beneath my head, saying,
"Now you'll be better. And when you get all right, you know how bad a shape you've been in. Here, now, take a sip of this water."
And me drinking and seeing her warm brown fingers holding the bright glass, and a feeling of old, almost forgotten relief coming over me, and thinking in echo of her words, "If I don't think I'm sinking, look what a hole I'm in." And then the soft, cool splash of sleep. I saw her across the room when I awoke, reading a newspaper, her glasses low across the bridge of her nose as she stared at the page intently. Then I realized that though the glasses still slanted down, the eyes were no longer focused on the page, but on my face, and lighting with a slow smile.
"How you feel now?" she said.
Much better.
"I thought you would be. And you'll be even better after you have a cup of soup I got for you in the kitchen. You slept a good long time."
"Did I?" I said. What time is it?"
"It's about 10 o'clock. And from the way you slept, I suspects all you needed was some rest." "No, don't get up yet. You got to drink your soup. Then you can go," she said, leaving.
She returned with a bowl and a plate.
"This here'll fix you up," she said. "You don't get this kind of service up there at Men's House, do you? Now you just sit there and take your time. I ain't got nothing to do but read the paper, and I like the company. You have to make time in the morning?"
"No, I've been sick," I said, "but I have to look for a job."
"I knowed you wasn't well. Why you try to hide it?"
I didn't want to be trouble to anyone," I said.
"Everybody has to be trouble to somebody. And you just come from the hospital, too?"
I looked up. She sat in the rocking chair, bent forward, her arms folded at ease across her aproned lap. Had she searched my pockets? "How did you know that?" I said.
"There you go getting suspicious," she said sternly. "That's what's wrong with the world today. Don't nobody trust nobody. I can smell that hospital smell on you, son. You got enough ether in those clothes to put to sleep a dog."
I couldn't remember telling you that I'd been in the hospital.
"No, and you didn't have to. I smelled that out. You got people here in the city?"
"No, ma'am," I said. "They're down south. I came up here to work so I could go to school, and I got sick."
"Now, ain't that too bad. But you make out all right. What do you plan to make out of yourself?"
"I don't know, now. I came here wanting to be an educator. Now, I don't know."
"What's wrong with being an educator?"
I thought about it while sipping the good hot soup. "Nothing, I suppose. I just think I'd like to do something else."
"Well, whatever it is, I hope it's something that's a credit to the race."
"I hope so," I said.
"Don't hope. Make it that way."
I looked at her, thinking of what I'd tried to do and of where it had gotten me. Seeing her heavy, composed figure before me.
"It's you young folks what's going to make the changes," she says. "Y'all's the ones. You got to lead and you got to fight and move us all on up a little higher. And I tell you something else. It's the ones from the south that's got to do it. Them what knows the fire and ain't forgot how it burns. Up here, too many forgets. They finds a place for theyselves and forgets the ones on the bottom. Oh, a heap of them talks about doing things, but they done really forgot. No, it's you young ones what has to remember and take the lead."
Yes, I said.
"And you have to take care of yourself, son. Don't let this Harlem get you. I'm in New York, but New York ain't in me, understand what I mean? Don't get corrupted."
"I won't. I'll be too busy."
"All right, now. You looks to me like you might make something out of yourself. So you be careful."
I got up to go, watching her raise herself out of her chair and come with me to the door.
"You ever decide you want a room somewhere beside Men's House, Try me, she said. The rent's reasonable.
I'll remember that, I said. I was to remember sooner than I had thought. The moment I entered the bright, buzzing lobby of Men's House, I was overcome by a sense of alienation and hostility. My overalls were causing stares, and I knew that I could live there no longer, that that phase of my life was past. The lobby was the meeting place for various groups still caught up in the illusions that had just been boomeranged out of my head. College boys working to return to school down south. Older advocates of racial progress with utopian schemes for building black business empires. Preachers, ordained by no authority except their own, without church or congregation, without bread or wine, body or blood. The community leaders without followers. Old men of 60 or more still caught up in post-Civil War dreams of freedom within segregation. The pathetic ones who possessed nothing beyond their dreams of being gentlemen, who held small jobs or drew small pensions, and all pretending to be engaged in some vast, though obscure, enterprise, who affected the pseudo-courtly manners of certain southern congressmen, and bowed and nodded as they passed like senile old roosters in a barnyard. The younger crowd, for whom I now felt a contempt such as only a disillusioned dreamer feels for those still unaware that they dream. The business students from southern colleges, for whom business was a vague, abstract game with rules as obsolete as Noah's Ark, but who yet were drunk on finance. Yes. And the older group with similar aspirations, the fundamentalists, the actors who sought to achieve the status of brokers through imagination alone, a group of janitors and messengers who spent most of their wages on clothing such as was fashionable among Wall Street brokers with their Brooks Brothers suits and bowler hats, English umbrellas, black calfskin shoes and yellow gloves, with their orthodox and passionate argument as to what was the correct tie to wear, with what shirt, what shade of gray was correct for spats, and what would the Prince of Wales wear to a certain seasonal event. Should field glasses be slung from the right or from the left shoulder? Who never read the financial pages, though they purchased the Wall Street Journal religiously and carried it beneath their left elbow, pressed firm against the body and grasped in the left hand, always manicured and gloved, fair weather or foul, with an easy precision. Oh, they had style. While the other hand whipped a tightly rolled umbrella back and forth at a calculated angle, with their Hamburgs and Chesterfields, their polo coats and Tyrolean hats worn strictly as fashion demanded. I could feel their eyes, saw them all, and saw too the time when they would know that my prospects were ended, and saw already the contempt they'd feel for me, a college man who had lost his prospects and pride. I could see it all. And I knew that even the officials and the older men would despise me as though somehow in losing my place in Bledsoe's world I had betrayed them. I saw it as they looked at my overalls. I had started toward the elevator when I heard the voice, raised in laughter, and turned to see him holding forth to a group in the lobby chairs and saw the rolls of fat behind the wrinkled, high-domed, close-cut head, and I was certain that it was he, and stooped without thought and lifted its shining full and foul and moved forward two long steps, dumping its great brown transparent splash upon the head, warned too late by someone across the room, and too late for me to see that it was not Bledsoe, but a preacher, a prominent Baptist, who shot up wide-eyed with disbelief and outrage, and I shot around and out of the lobby before anyone could think to stop me. No one followed me, and I wandered the streets amazed at my own action. Later it began to rain, and I sneaked back near Men's House and persuaded an amused porter to slip my things out to me. I learned that I had been barred from the building for 99 years and a day.
"You might not can come back, man," the porter said, "but after what you did, I swear, they never will stop talking about you. You really baptized old Rev." So that same night, I went back to Mary's, where I lived in a small but comfortable room until the ice came. It was a period of quietness. I paid my way with my compensation money and found living with her pleasant, except for her constant talk about leadership and responsibility. And even this was not too bad as long as I could pay my way. It was, however, a small compensation, and when after several months my money ran out and I was looking again for a job, I found her exceedingly irritating to listen to. Still, she never dunned me and was as generous with her servings of food during mealtime as ever.
"It's just hard times you're going through," she'd say. "Everybody worth their salt has his hard times. And when you get to be somebody, you'll see these here very same hard times helped you a heap."
I didn't see it that way. I had lost my sense of direction. I spent my time, when not looking for work, in my room where I read countless books from the library. Sometimes, when there was still money or when I had earned a few dollars waiting table, I'd eat out and wander the streets until late at night. Other than Mary, I had no friends, and desired none. Nor did I think of Mary as a friend. She was something more, a force, a stable, familiar force, like something out of my past which kept me from whirling off into some unknown which I dared not face. It was a most painful position, for at the same time Mary reminded me constantly that something was expected of me, some act of leadership, some newsworthy achievement, and I was torn between resenting her for it and loving her for the nebulous hope she kept alive. I had no doubt that I could do something, but what and how? I had no context, and I believed in nothing. And the obsession with my identity, which I had developed in the factory hospital, returned with a vengeance. Who was I? How had I come to be? Certainly I couldn't help being different from when I left the campus, but now a new, painful, contradictory voice had grown up within me, and between its demands for revengeful action and Mary's silent pressure, I throbbed with guilt and puzzlement. I wanted peace and quiet, tranquility, but was too much a boil inside. Somewhere beneath the load of the emotion-freezing ice which my life had conditioned my brain to produce, a spot of black anger glowed and threw off a hot red light of such intensity that, had Lord Kelvin known of its existence, he would have had to revise his measurements. A remote explosion had occurred somewhere, perhaps back at Emerson's or that night in Bledsoe's office, and it had caused the ice cap to melt and shift the slightest bit. But that bit, that fraction, was irrevocable. Coming to New York had perhaps been an unconscious attempt to keep the old freezing unit going, but it hadn't worked. Hot water had gotten into its coils. Only a drop, perhaps, but that drop was the first wave of the deluge. One moment I believed I was dedicated, willing to lie on the blazing coals, do anything to attain a position on the campus. Then, snap! It was done with, finished, through. Now there was only the problem of forgetting it. If only all the contradictory voices shouting inside my head would calm down and sing a song in unison. Whatever it was, I wouldn't care as long as they sang without dissonance. Yes. And avoided the uncertain extremes of the scale. But there was no relief. I was wild with resentment, but too much under self-control, that frozen virtue, that freezing vice. And the more resentful I became, the more my old urge to make speeches returned. While walking along the streets, words would spill from my lips in a mumble over which I had little control. I became afraid of what I might do. All things were indeed awash in my mind. I longed for home.
and while the ice was melting to form a flood in which I threatened to drown, I awoke one afternoon to find that my first northern winter had set. At first I had turned away from the window and tried to read, but my mind kept wandering back to my old problems, and unable to endure it any longer, I rushed from the house, extremely agitated, but determined to get away from my hot thoughts into the chill air. At the entrance, I bumped against a woman who called me a filthy name, only causing me to increase my speed. In a few minutes, I was several blocks away, having moved to the next avenue and downtown. The streets were covered with ice and soot-flecked snow, and from above a feeble sun filtered through the haze. I walked with my head down, feeling the biting air, and yet I was hot, burning with an inner fever. I barely raised my eyes until a car, passing with a thudding of skid chains, whirled completely around on the ice, then turned cautiously and thudded off again. I walked slowly on, blinking my eyes in the chill air, my mind a blur with the hot inner argument continuing. The whole of Harlem seemed to fall apart in the swirl of snow. I imagined I was lost, and for a moment there was an eerie quiet. I imagined I heard the fall of snow upon snow. What did it mean? I walked, my eyes focused into the endless succession of barbershops, beauty parlors, confectionaries, luncheonettes, fish houses, and hogmaw joints. Walking close to the windows, the snowflakes lacing swift between, simultaneously forming a curtain, a veil, and stripping it aside. A flash of red and gold from a window filled with religious articles caught my eye, and behind the film of frost etching the glass, I saw two brashly painted plaster images of Mary and Jesus surrounded by dream books, love powders, God is love signs, money drawing oil, and plastic dice. A black statue of a nude Nubian slave grinned out at me from beneath a turban of gold. I passed on to a window decorated with switches of wiry false hair, ointments guaranteed to produce the miracle of whitening black skin. You too can be truly beautiful, a sign proclaimed. Win greater happiness with whiter complexion. Be outstanding in your social set. I hurried on, suppressing a savage urge to push my fist through the pane. A wind was rising, the snow thinning. Where would I go? To a movie? Could I sleep there? I ignored the windows now and walked along, becoming aware that I was muttering to myself again. Then, far down at the corner, I saw an old man warming his hands against the sides of an odd-looking wagon, from which a stovepipe reeled off a thin spiral of smoke that drifted the odor of baking yams slowly to me, bringing a stab of swift nostalgia. I stopped as though struck by a shot, deeply inhaling, remembering, my mind surging back, back. At home, we'd bake them in the hot coals of the fireplace, had carried them cold to school for lunch, munched them secretly, squeezing the sweet pulp from the soft peel as we hid from the teacher behind the largest book of the world's geography. Yes, and we'd love them candied or baked in a cobbler. Deep fat fried in a pocket of dough or roasted with pork and glazed, ooh, with the well-browned fat. I chewed them raw, yams, and years ago. More yams than years ago. For the time seemed endlessly expanded, stretched thin as the spiraling smoke beyond all recall. I moved again. "Get your hot-baked Carolina yam," he called. At the corner, the old man, wrapped in an army overcoat, his feet covered with gunny sacks, his head in a knitted cap, was puttering with a stack of paper bags. I saw a crude sign on the side of the wagon proclaiming, "Yams."
as I walked flush into the warmth thrown by the coals that glowed in a grate underneath.
"How much are your yams?" I said, suddenly hungry. "They 10 cents and they sweet," he said, his voice quavering with age. "These ain't none of them binding ones, neither. These here is real sweet yellow yams. How many?"
"One," I said. "If they're that good, one should be enough." He gave me a searching glance. There was a tear in the corner of his eye. He chuckled and opened the door of the improvised oven, reaching gingerly with his gloved hand. The yam, some bubbling with syrup, lay on a wire rack above glowing coals that leaped to low blue flame when struck by the draft of air. The flash of warmth set my face aglow as he removed one of the yams and shut the door.
"Here you are, sir," he said, starting to put the yam into a bag.
Never mind the bag. I'm going to eat it. Here."
"Thanks."
He took the dime.
"If that ain't a sweet one, I'll give you another one, free of charge."
I knew that it was sweet before I broke it. Bubbles of brown syrup had burst the skin.
"Go ahead and break it," the old man said. "Break it, and I'll give you some butter, since you gonna eat it right here. And lots of folks take some home. They got their own butter at home."
I broke it, seeing the sugary pulp steaming in the cold.
"Hold it over here," he said.
He took a crock from a rack on the side of the wagon.
"Right here."
I held it, watching him pour a spoonful of melted butter over the yam and the butter seeping in. "Thanks."
"You welcome. I tell you something."
"What's that?" I said.
"If that ain't the best eating you had in a long time, I give you your money back."
"You don't have to convince me," I said. "I can look at it and see it's good."
"You right, but everything what looks good ain't necessarily good," he said. "But these is..."
I took a bite, finding it as sweet and hot as any I'd ever had, and was overcome with such a surge of homesickness that I turned away to keep my control. I walked along, munching the yam, just as suddenly overcome by an intense feeling of freedom, simply because I was eating while walking along the street. It was exhilarating. I no longer had to worry about who saw me or about what was proper. To hell with all that, and as sweet as the yam actually was, it became like nectar with the thought. If only someone who had known me at school or at home would come along and see me now, how shocked they'd be. I'd push them into a side street and smear their faces with the peel. What a group of people we were, I thought. Why, you could cause us the greatest humiliation simply by confronting us with something we liked. Not all of us, but so many. Simply by walking up and shaking a set of chitterlings or a well-boiled hogmaw at them during the clear light of day. What consternation it would cause. And I saw myself advancing upon Bledsoe, standing bare of his false humility in the crowded lobby of Men's House, and seeing him there, and seeing me and ignoring me, and me enraged and suddenly whipping out a foot or two of chitterlings, raw, uncleaned, and dripping sticky circles on the floor as I shake them in his face, shouting, "Bledsoe, you're a shameless chitterling eater. I accuse you of relishing hog bowel." "And not only do you eat them, you sneak and eat them in private when you think you're unobserved. You're a sneaking chitterling lover. I accuse you of indulging in a filthy habit, Bledsoe. Lug them out of there, Bledsoe. Lug them out so we can see. I accuse you before the eyes of the world." And he lugs them out, yards of them with mustard greens and racks of pig's ears and pork chops and black-eyed peas with dull, accusing eyes. I let out a wild laugh, almost choking over the yam as the scene spun before me. Why, with others present, it would be worse than if I had accused him of raping an old woman of 99 years, weighing 90 pounds, blind in one eye and lame in the hip. Bledsoe would disintegrate, disinflate with a profound sigh. He'd drop his head in shame. He'd lose caste. The weekly newspapers would attack him. The captions over his picture, "Prominent Educator Reverts to Field Niggerism."
his arrivals would denounce him as a bad example for the youth. Editorials would demand that he either recant or retire from public life. In the South, his white folks would desert him. He would be discussed far and wide, and all the trustees' money couldn't prop up his sagging prestige. He'd end up an exile washing dishes at the automat. For down South, he'd be unable to get a job on the honey wagon. This is all very wild and childish, I thought, but to hell with being ashamed of what you liked. No more of that for me. I am what I am. I wolfed down the yam and ran back to the old man and handed him 20 cents. Give me 2 more, I said.
Sure, oh, you won't. As long as I got 'em, I can see you a serious yam eater, young fella. You eating 'em right away?
As soon as you give them to me, I said.
You want 'em butted? Please. Sure, that way you can get the most out of 'em. Yes, sir, he said, handing over the yams. I can see you one of these old-fashioned yam eaters.
They're my birthmark, I said. I yam what I am.
Then you must be from South Carolina, he said with a grin.
South Carolina, nothing. Where I come from, we really go for yams.
Come back tonight or tomorrow if you can eat some more, he called after me. My old lady be out here with some hot, sweet potato fried pies.
Hot fried pies, I thought sadly, moving away. I would probably have indigestion if I ate one. Now that I no longer felt ashamed of the things I always loved, I probably could no longer digest very many of them. What and how much had I lost by trying to do only what was expected of me, instead of what I myself had wished to do? What a waste. What a senseless waste. But what of those things which you actually didn't like? Not because you were not supposed to like them. Not because to dislike them was considered a mark of refinement and education. But because you actually found them distasteful. The very idea annoyed me. How could you know? It involved a problem of choice. I would have to weigh many things carefully before deciding. And there would be some things that would cause quite a bit of trouble, simply because I had never formed a personal attitude towards so much. I had accepted the accepted attitudes, and it had made life seem simple. But not yams. I had no problem concerning them, and I would eat them whenever and wherever I took the notion. Continue on the yam level, and life would be sweet, though somewhat yellowish. Yet the freedom to eat yams on the street was far less than I had expected upon coming to the city. An unpleasant taste bloomed in my mouth now as I bit the end of the yam and threw it into the street. It had been frostbitten. The wind drove me into a side street where a group of boys had set a packing box afire. The gray smoke hung low and seemed to thicken as I walked with my head down and eyes closed, trying to avoid the fumes. My lungs began to pain. Then, emerging, wiping my eyes and coughing, I almost stumbled over it. It was piled in a jumble along the walk and over the curb, into the street like a lot of junk, waiting to be hauled away. Then I saw the sullen-faced crowd, looking at a building where 2 white men were toting out a chair in which an old woman sat, who, as I watched, struck at them feebly with her fists. A motherly-looking old woman with her head tied in a handkerchief, wearing a man's shoes and a man's heavy blue sweater. It was startling. The crowd watching silently, the 2 white men lugging the chair and trying to dodge the blows, and the old woman's face streaming with angry tears as she thrashed at them with her fists. I couldn't believe it. Something, a sense of foreboding, filled me, a quick sense of uncleanliness.
"Leave us alone," she cried. "Leave us alone,"
as the men pulled their heads out of range and sat her down abruptly at the curb, hurrying back into the building. What on earth, I thought, looking above me. What
on earth? The old woman sobbed, pointing to the stuff piled along the curb.
Just look at what they're doing to us! Just look!
Looking straight at me. And I realized that what I'd taken for junk was actually worn household furnishings.
Just look at what they're doing, she said,
her teary eyes upon my face. I looked away, embarrassed, staring into the rapidly growing crowd. Faces were peering sullenly from the windows above, and now, as the two men reappeared at the top of the steps carrying a battered chest of drawers, I saw a third man come out and stand behind them, pulling at his ear as he looked out over the crowd.
"Shake it up, you fellas," he said. "Shake it up. We don't have all day."
Then the men came down with the chest, and I saw the crowd give way sullenly, the men trudging through, grunting and putting the chest at the curb, then returning into the building without a glance to left or right.
"Look at that," a slender man near me said. "We ought to beat the hell out those paddies."
I looked silently into his face, taut and ashy in the cold, his eyes trained upon the men going up the steps.
"Sure, we ought to stop 'em," another man said, "but ain't that much nerve in the whole bunch." "There's plenty nerve," the slender man said. "All they need is someone to set it off. All they need is a leader." "You mean you don't have the nerve?"
"Who, me?" the man said.
Who, me? Yes, you."
"Just look," the old woman said. "Just look."
Her face still turned toward mine. I turned away, edging closer to the two men. "Who are those men?" I said, edging closer.
"Marshals or something. I don't give a damn who they is."
"Marshals hell," another man said. "Those guys doing all the toting ain't nothing but trustees. Soon as they get through, they lock 'em up again."
"I don't care who they are. They got no business putting these old folks out on the sidewalk."
"You mean they're putting them out of their apartment?" I said. "They can do that up here?"
"Man, where you from?" he said, swinging toward me. "What does it look they putting them out of? A Pullman car? They being evicted."
I was embarrassed. Others were turning to stare. I had never seen an eviction. Someone snickered.
"Where did he come from?"
A flash of heat went over me and I turned. "Look, friend," I said, hearing a hot edge coming into my voice, "I asked a civil question. If you don't care to answer, don't. But don't try to make me look ridiculous."
"Ridiculous, hell. All scobos is ridiculous. Who the hell is you?"
"Never mind. I am who I am. Just don't beat up your gums at me," I said, throwing him a newly acquired phrase. Just then, one of the men came down the steps with an armful of articles, and I saw the old woman reach up, yelling,
"Take your hands off my Bible!"
And the crowd surged forward. The white man's hot eyes swept the crowd.
"Where, lady?" he said. "I don't see any Bible."
And I saw her snatch the book from his arms, clutching it fiercely and sending forth a shriek.
"They can come in your home and do what they want to you," she said. "Just come stomping and jerk your life up by the roots. But this here's the last straw. They ain't gonna bother with my Bible."
The white man eyed the crowd.
"Look, lady," he said, more to the rest of us than to her. "I don't want to do this. I have to. They sent me up here to do it. If it was left to me, you could stay here till hell freezes over."
These white folks, Lord, these white folks,"
she moaned. Her eyes turned toward the sky as an old man pushed past me and went to her.
Hun, he said, placing his hand on her shoulder. It's the agent, not these gentlemen. He's the one. He says it's the bank, but you know he's the one. We've done business with him for over 20 years.
"Don't tell me," she said. "It's all the white folks, not just one. They all against us. Every stinking low down one of them."
"She's right," a hoarse voice said. "She's right. They all is."
Something had been working fiercely inside of me, and for a moment I had forgotten the rest of the crowd. Now I recognized a self-consciousness about them, as though we were ashamed to witness the eviction, as though we were all unwilling intruders upon some shameful event, and thus we were careful not to touch or stare too hard at the effects that lined the curb. For
We were witnesses of what we did not wish to see, though curious, fascinated, despite our shame, and through it all, the old female, mind-plunging, crying. I looked at the old people, feeling my eyes burn, my throat tighten. The old woman's sobbing was having a strange effect upon me, as when a child, seeing the tears of its parents, is moved by both fear and sympathy to cry. I turned away, feeling myself being drawn to the old couple by a warm, dark, rising whirlpool of emotion, which I feared. I was wary of what the sight of them crying there on the sidewalk was making me begin to feel. I wanted to leave, but was too ashamed to leave, was rapidly becoming too much a part of it to leave. I turned aside and looked at the clutter of household objects which the two men continued to pile on the walk. As the crowd pushed me, I looked down to see, looking out of an oval frame, a portrait of the old couple when young. Seeing the sad, stiff dignity of the faces there, feeling strange memories awaken that began an echoing in my head like that of a hysterical voice stuttering in a dark street, seeing them look back at me as though even then, in that 19th-century day, they had expected little, and this with a grim, unillusioned pride that suddenly seemed to me both a reproach and a warning. My eyes fell upon a pair of crudely carved and polished bones, knocking bones, used to accompany music at country dances, used in blackface minstrels. The flat ribs of a cow, a steer, or sheep, flat bones that gave off a sound and struck like heavy castanets. Had he been a minstrel? Or the wooden block of a set of drums? Pots and pots of green plants were lined in the dirty snow, certain to die of the cold. Ivy, canna, a tomato plant. And in the basket I saw a straightening comb, switches of false hair, a curling iron, a card with silvery letters against a background of dark red velvet reading, God bless our home. And scattered across the top of a chiffonier were nuggets of High John the Conqueror, the Lucky Stone. And as I watched the white men put down a basket in which I saw a whiskey bottle filled with rock candy and camphor, a small Ethiopian flag, a faded tintype of Abraham Lincoln, and the smiling image of a Hollywood star torn from a magazine. And on a pillow, several badly cracked pieces of delicate china, a commemorative plate celebrating the St. Louis World's Fair. I stood in a kind of daze, looking at an old folded lace fan studded with jet and mother-of-pearl. The crowd surged as the white men came back, knocking over a drawer that spilled its contents in the snow at my feet. I stooped and started replacing the articles. A bent Masonic emblem, a set of tarnished cufflinks, three brass rings, a dime pierced with a nail hole so as to be worn about the ankle on a string for luck, an ornate greeting card with the message, Grandma, I love you, in childish scrawl. Another card, with a picture of what looked like a white man in blackface seated in the door of a cabin, strumming a banjo beneath a bar of music and the lyric, Going back to my old cabin home. A useless inhalant, a string of bright glass beads with a tarnished clasp, a rabbit foot, a celluloid baseball scoring card shaped like a catcher's mitt, registering a game won or lost years ago. An old breast pump with rubber bulb yellowed with age, a worn baby shoe, and a dusty lock of infant hair tied with a faded and crumpled blue ribbon. I felt nauseated. In my hand I held three lapsed life insurance policies with perforated seals stamped void, a yellowing newspaper portrait of a huge black man with the caption, Marcus Garvey, deported. I turned away, bending and searching the dirty snow for anything missed by my eyes, and my fingers closed upon something, resting in a frozen footstep, a fragile paper coming apart with age, written in black ink, grown yellow. I read, "Free papers. Be it known to all men that my Negro, Primus Provo, has been freed by me this 6th day of August, 1859. Signed, John Samuels, Macon." I folded it quickly, blotting out the single drop of melted snow which glistened on the yellowed page, and dropped it back into the drawer. My hands were trembling, my breath rasping, as if I had run a long distance or come upon a coiled snake in a busy street. It has been longer than that, further removed in time, I told myself. And yet I knew that it hadn't been. I replaced the drawer in the chest and pushed drunkenly to the curb. But it wouldn't come up. Only a bitter spurt of gall filled my mouth and splattered the old folks' possessions. I turned and stared again at the jumble, no longer looking at what was before my eyes, but inwardly, outwardly, around a corner into the dark, far away and long ago. Not so much of my own memory as of remembered words, of linked verbal echoes, images heard even when not listening at home. And it was as though I myself was being dispossessed of some painful yet precious thing which I could not bear to lose. Something confounding, like a rotted tooth that one would rather suffer indefinitely than endure the short, violent eruption of pain that would mark its removal. And with this sense of dispossession came a pang of vague recognition. This junk, these shabby chairs, these heavy, old-fashioned pressing irons, zinc wash tubs with dented bottoms, all throbbed within me with more meaning than there should have been. And why did I, standing in the crowd, see like a vision my mother, hanging wash on a cold, windy day, so cold that the warm clothes froze even before the vapor thinned and hung stiff on the line, and her hands white and raw in the skirt swirling wind, and her gray head bare to the darkened sky? Why were they causing me discomfort so far beyond their intrinsic meaning as objects? And why did I see them now, as behind a veil that threatened to lift, stirred by the cold wind in the narrow street? A scream, "I'm going in!" spun me around. The old couple were on the steps now. The old man holding her arm, the white men leaning forward above, and the crowd pressing me closer to the steps.
"You can't go in, lady," the man said.
"I want to pray," she said. "I can't help it, lady. You'll have to do your praying out here." "I'm going in, not in here. All we want is to go in and pray," she said, clutching her Bible. "It ain't right to pray in the street like this."
"I'm sorry," he said. "Ah, let the woman go in to pray," a voice called from the crowd. "You got all their stuff out here on the walk. What more do you want, blood? Sure, let them old folks pray." "That's what's wrong with us now, all this damn praying," another voice called. "You don't go back, see," the white man said. "You were legally evicted." "But all we want to do is go in and kneel on the floor," the old man said. "We've been living right here for over 20 years. I don't see why you just can't let us go just for a few minutes." "Look, I've told you," the man said. "I've got my orders. You're wasting my time."
"We're going in," the woman said.
It happened so suddenly that I could barely keep up with it. I saw the old woman clutching her Bible and rushing up the steps, her husband behind her and the white man stepping in front of them and stretching out his arm.
"I'll jug you," he yelled. "By God, I'll jug you." "Take your hands off that woman," someone called from the crowd.
Then, at the top of the stairs, they were pushing against the man, and I saw the old woman fall backwards, and the crowd exploded.
"Get that Patty, son of a bitch! He struck her," a West Indian woman screamed in my ear. "The filthy brute, he struck her!" "Stand back or I'll shoot," the man called, his eyes wild as he drew a gun and backed into the doorway where the two trustees stood bewildered, their arms full of articles. "I swear, I'll shoot.
You don't know what you're doing, but I'll shoot.
They hesitated.
Ain't but 6 bullets in that thing, a little fellow called. Then what you gonna do? Yeah, you damn sure can't hide.
I advise you to stay out of this, the marshal called.
Think you can come up here and hit one of our women? You a fool. To hell with all this talk. Let's rush that bastard.
You better think twice, the white man called.
I saw them start up the steps, and suddenly, as though my head would split, I knew that they were about to attack the man, and I was both afraid and angry, repelled and fascinated. I both wanted it and feared the consequences, was outraged and angered at what I saw, and yet surged with fear, not for the man or for the consequences of an attack, but of what the sight of violence might release in me. And beneath it all, there boiled up all the shock-absorbing phrases that I had learned all my life. I seemed to totter on the edge of a great dark hole.
No, I heard myself yelling. Black men, black brothers, black brothers. That's not the way. We're law-abiding. We're a law-abiding people and a slow-to-anger people.
Forcing my way quickly through the crowd, I stood on the steps, facing those in front, talking rapidly without thought but out of my clashing emotions.
We're a law-abiding people and a slow-to-anger people.
They stopped, listening. Even the white man was startled.
Yeah, but we mad now, a voice called out.
Yes, you're right, I called back. We're angry, but let us be wise. Let us learn from that great leader whose wise action was reported in the newspaper the other day.
What, man? Who?
A West Indian voice shouted.
Come on, to hell with this guy. Let's get that paddy before they send him some help.
No, wait, I yelled. Let's follow a leader. Let's organize. We need someone like that wise leader. You read about him down in Alabama. He was strong enough to choose to do the wise thing in spite of what he felt himself. Who, man? Who?
This was it, I thought. They're listening, eager to listen. Nobody laughed. If they laugh, I'll die. I tensed my diaphragm.
That wise man, I said. You read about him. Who, when that fugitive escaped from the mob and ran to his school for protection. That wise man who was strong enough to do the legal thing, the law-abiding thing, to turn him over to the forces of law and order.
Yeah, a voice rang out. Yeah, so they could lynch his ass.
Oh, God, this wasn't it at all. Poor technique and not at all what I intended.
He was a wise leader, I yelled. He was within the law. Now, wasn't that the wise thing to do?
Yeah, he was wise, all right, the man laughed angrily. Now get out of the way so we can jump this paddy.
The crowd yelled, and I laughed in response as though hypnotized.
But wasn't that the human thing to do? After all, he had to protect himself because
he was a handkerchief-headed rat,
a woman screamed, her voice boiling with contempt.
Yes, you're right. He was wise and cowardly. But what about us? What are we to do?
I yelled, suddenly thrilled by the response. Look at him, I cried.
Yes, just look at him,
an old fellow in a derby called out as though answering a preacher in a church. And at that old couple.
Yeah, what about Sister and Brother Provo, he said. It's an ungodly shame.
And look at their possessions, all strewn there on the sidewalk. Just look at their possessions in the snow.
How old are you, sir? I yelled.
I'm 87,
the old man said, his voice low and bewildered.
How's that? Yell, so our slow-to-anger brethren can hear you. I'm 87 years old.
Did you hear him? He's 87. 87. And look at all he's accumulated in 87 years, strewn in the snow like chicken guts. And we're a law-abiding, slow-to-anger bunch of folks turning the other cheek every day in the week. And what are we going to do? What would you do? What would I? What would he have done?
What is to be done?
I propose we do the wise thing, the law-abiding thing.
Just look at this junk. Should 2 old folks live in such junk, cooped up in a filthy room? It's a danger. A fire hazard. Old cracked dishes and broken down chairs. Yes, yes, yes! Look at that old woman. Somebody's